Over the last few months, seems like years, our Western Carolina University musicians, many on our worship team are from Western Carolina University, all of a sudden, like Elisha, the brook dried up. In other words, they made their money from doing gigs and playing it as a band and going to different functions. Well, all of a sudden, no opportunities. So we continued to pay, right? We continued to be a source of income for them and even bless them a little bit beyond that. And it's just wonderful to see them grow. So over the last few months, you may not realize this, is like these people are really growing in Christ. This is really exciting. Some of them are coming over to the house this afternoon and probably going to eat all of our good food, but that's okay. There's some good things going on in the midst of a storm. Okay, so let's finish this up, shall we? Let's finish up this series in Ephesians chapter 6, and we're going to look at verse 11 and following. Okay, at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction of U2, the band, the lead singer Bono, in his acceptance speech, told a story that sort of told the story of the band in a way, back in the 80s. There are different versions of the story online, but the main point of the story stays the same. It goes something like this. Back in 1983, Bono had been at the Chicago Museum of Peace and saw an exhibit on MLK. Apparently, it profoundly affected him. He was enamored with this whole idea of how Martin Luther King brought about peace in the midst of turmoil in a way different than Malcolm X. So anyway, he just kind of tucked that in his heart. Later on, he wrote a song entitled Pride. You know the lyrics. You probably heard them on the radio. It goes like this. In the name of love. Okay. A certain line or two in that song talk about April 4th, 1968, which was the day of the assassination of Martin Luther King. He actually said it was morning in the song, but it was actually in the evening. Late afternoon, but sometimes he changes the lyrics. Anyway, that song became very important to the culture and to the band. And then later in 1987, a controversy came up. Ronald Reagan, I think it was an executive order, made Martin Luther, and with the help of Congress, made Martin Luther King a national holiday. Well, there was some controversy over that at the time. Governor Evan Meckham of Arizona, there was a controversy around the policy of that state as to whether that would be a paid holiday or not. I don't even know all the details. Nonetheless, it was controversial. So to say, the long story short, there was a death threat put out against Bono. And if he sang that song, as this narrative goes, at Tempe, Arizona, at Sun Devil Stadium, on the campus of Arizona State University, he would be killed. It was a death threat. So the FBI got involved and came to the conclusion that the death threat was credible, that they heightened security, and they asked the U2 to actually cancel that show. Bono thought about it, talked to the band, and decided that they were going to sing the song that honored Dr. King, because he probably received a whole lot more death threats than they had. So the day came for the concert, and sure enough, Bono steps up to the microphone, and it's time to sing that song, and he begins to sing those words. He closes his eyes, which I don't know if it's a habit of his, I wouldn't think so, but he closes his eyes during the song, and he sings the lyrics. And as he's getting to the end of the song, he opens his eyes. Unbeknownst to him, during the entire song, Adam Clayton, his bass guitarist, was standing in front of him. It was something about the band and the fabric of who they are that they had been through a lot together as a band, and they had taken care of one another through ups and downs. Was it something that Adam Clayton had planned? I don't know. But in the moment, he felt like that was the way to respond to the threat, to stand. Just so happens that in the Christian life, the battle stance is the same. stand. You have to stand. You have to stand firm. You have to stand your ground. You have to stand on holy ground. But having done all, at least stand. It is the battle stance of the spiritual war that's taking place and has been taking place in the world since the inception of the church. The Bible is more than peppered with vernacular that addresses this issue of spiritual conflict, spiritual war, spiritual tension between the church of Jesus Christ and the darkness. Matthew 16 and 18 says, "The gates of hell shall not prevail against it," speaking of the church. 1 Timothy 6 and 12, "Fight the good fight of faith and lay on eternal life." 2 Timothy 2 and 3, "Endure hardship." That's encouraging. "Endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ." James 4 and 7, "Resist the devil and he will flee." All right, so there is a war, we know, going on against between the darkness and the church. We know that the darkness is geographical. It's not omnipresent. We know that the darkness has an agenda, and we're about to read that the darkness has schemes. We've been talking about this lately. All right, that having been the case, let's parenthetically pause for a second. What does the number 244 mean to anyone here? 244, any idea what that would mean to us? Oh, really? Well, it happens to be the age of our nation today. What's going on here? You with me? Are you with me? Okay, 244. Was anyone here when the nation was formed 244 years ago? Was anybody here? No, okay. All right. Well, that was in 1776. In 1892, a man by the name of Francis Bellamy, he was a minister, said to be a socialist minister, wrote what he intended to be a pledge of allegiance for every nation. All right, he wrote this pledge of allegiance for every nation. And when he wrote it, he published it in Youth Companion magazine in September of 1892. And the pledge of allegiance, he said, "I pledge allegiance to my flag and the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all." I don't know how it could be any nation with a republic, but nonetheless, "I pledge allegiance to my flag and the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all." In 1923, the words "the flag of the United States of America" were added, and at this time it read, "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all." Not until 1954 did President Eisenhower, post-World War II, add the words "one nation under God." So now we have, "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all." Now, there's a whole protocol, if you didn't realize this, you're about to. There's a whole protocol surrounding the Pledge of Allegiance. How many of you recited the Pledge of Allegiance in school or grown up? Okay. Did you have a choice? No. I wonder if they still do that. I don't know. Probably not everywhere. Section 4 of the Flag Code states, "A pledge of allegiance to the flag should be rendered by standing at attention, facing the flag with the right hand over the heart." This is in the code book now. "When not in uniform, men should remove any non-religious headdress." Thank God we don't have religious headdress in this church. That would just be so hot. "With their right hand and hold it in their left shoulder." So you got to put your hand over your hat over here. "And hand being over the heart. Persons in uniform should remain silent, face the flag, and render the military salute." Okay. The original Bellamy salute began with a military salute, and after reciting the words to the flag, the arm was extended toward the flag, right? At a signal from the principal, the pupils in ordered ranks, hands to the side, face to the flag. Another signal is given while pupil gives the flag the military salute, right hand lifted up, palm downward to align with the forehead and close to it. In World War II, this is great. In World War II, the salute too much resembled the Nazi salute. So it was changed to keep the right hand over the heart throughout. All right, there you have it. There's your background on the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. If there is a conflict, a war against the Church of Jesus Christ and this nation, as part of his scheme, would it not also make sense, if you really think about this, if the church and the nation, if there's little separation between the two, if you bring down the nation, then you tarnish the witness of the church. Look at these words. One nation under God, that's in jeopardy. Indivisible? Not so much. Liberty and justice for all. Is it not possible that there is a scheme in place from the father of lies, which speaks his natural language, which is lies, to indirectly bring down the church or the association of the church with the nation by bringing down the nation? Makes sense. With that in mind, let's go to Ephesians chapter 6, verse 11 to 14. Put on the full armor of God. All right? Full armor. I just watched Tolkien last night, Fellowship of the Rings. I'm really into this armor thing. And just, oh, man. Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Okay. Therefore, put on the full armor of God so that when, that's twice you see that, so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to, look at their battle stance, stand your ground, and after having done everything to stand, stand firm then going forward. All right, there's a lot of understanding and acceptance of the idea that there's a war, a spiritual war, a conflict going on over the church and the land. Nobody would disagree with that. Now, it begs the question, what is our response in all of that? You know, like, what do we do? Like, what can we do on an individual basis? What can we do as a church to engage in contributing to the victory of overcoming this onslaught of darkness against the church? Great question. I'd love to hear your answers. Love to hear what you got figured out. Like, what can we do, right? What can we do to this onslaught of whatever you want to call it that erodes our submission to God, one nation under God, that erodes our unity, divisibility, and also really compromises justice for all? All right, there you have it. What do we do? It's one thing to say we have a problem. It's another thing to know what to do about the problem. Okay. Well, we have to put on the full armor of God. What does this mean? We have to stand with truth. We have to be able to decipher what is true and what is not, and how do we walk in truth, how do we understand truth, how do we share truth. All right, this is a very practical thing. This came up yesterday. This is very interesting to me. Someone here in the church, a friend of mine, sends me a text message yesterday of the defacing of the Vietnam Memorial. It's horrific. Graffiti defacing. I don't know. It looked to be like the first 3 feet of the Vietnam Memorial, totally defaced. And I looked at that and I go, oh, that's horrible. I was in the middle of sweeping up the porch at the time. To his credit, this is the point here. To his credit, he sends me a text back and says, Gary, in so many words, sorry. Turns out that happened 12 years ago, some other group. The group that was implicated doing it last week didn't do it, have anything to do with it. To his credit, okay? So this sounds like a small thing, but it's a huge thing. Christian people tend to be the most trustworthy people around, right? Very trusting people. The problem with being a very trusting people is that sometimes you get duped. Could we just kind of make an agreement from now on that we're going to fact check stuff, right? Can we fact check? You know, someone sent me something one time and I said, you know, this thing is, I was trying to be polite. It's like this has been around for 10 years and everyone knows that's not true. Please don't share that with half of Europe this afternoon. And she goes, oh, no, it's true. No, it's not. Everybody knows that. And with that goes our credibility. So when we share something, we have to have the belt buckle of truth. We have to know what the truth of the book is, but we also have to fact check, right? Okay. We lose credibility when we engage in God dialogue with people when we really don't know what we're talking about. We have to think as much as we feel. All right, fact check. So I credit this friend of mine who stayed on top of it, exactly what we need to do. Many times we're too trusting in things that come our way, and we're not naive sometimes. We just adopt something and it's like, oh, okay. Let me go pass this on. No, don't pass it on. Find out. Find out what's going on. We have to put on the full armor of God. Know what the truth is and speak the truth in love. Number two, we have the breastplate of righteousness. The fact that you stand is good, but you got to stand in a righteous manner. There's nothing better than standing up for what you believe in, standing up for the truth. But the way that you do it is so important because the way that you do it is perceived by people in different ways. And you have to be wise like a serpent and gentle like a dove. It's very important. You have to know how what you're saying is being perceived. The evangelical Christian has become so identified with and so enmeshed in a political realm that what happens in the political realm is a reflection on the evangelical Christian and vice versa. We have to know how we're being perceived. We have to be being perceived in a righteous way. And the feet fitted with the readiness of the gospel. Here's a question that here's a question that we should be asking ourselves often. Like almost daily, I would say. Like go overboard with this question for a while. And it's very revealing. It reveals our heart, reveals or something going on in a relationship. And that question is this: am I acting as a reconciler? Am I acting as a reconciler? Am I a minister of reconciliation? We need to be thinking about that question. I need to be thinking about that in my personal life, my family life, friendships, people, whatever. Am I seeking to, am I a peacemaker in life? The world needs a lot more peacemakers. Have you noticed? Am I being a peacemaker? Am I reconciling myself to someone else? All right, I had a pastor in Atlanta who got a hold of me early on in my walk and discipled me. And there's one area of my life, I wish he had never said this, but he did. And frankly, it was kind of right. He said, do the Hemingway thing, Gary. At the time, I had 14 pastors who were answering to me. He says, do the Hemingway thing. And, so, and finally, he just got to say Hemingway, and I knew what he's talking about. What did Hemingway do? Hemingway said, it's all my fault. I said, what? He goes, yeah, it's all your fault. He said, it's not really your fault. It's my fault because you work for me. But it's really your fault. Anything that goes wrong, ask yourself this question, is it my fault? And I thought, what? Man. And then I started doing that, and then I realized sometimes it was my fault. But if I hadn't asked the question, I never would have really understood it. If things aren't going the way I want them to go, is it in part my fault because I should have done something different? I should have led in a different manner. I should have said something. I should have intervened. I shouldn't have waited to do something. I could have reconciled the situation before it got out of hand. Is it my fault? And there's nothing wrong with asking that question. As long as you don't end up condemning yourself and walking in inferiority and shame the rest of your life, if you can handle it, ask yourself the question, is it my fault? Or is it on some level my fault? That's a healthy thing. Now, Hemingway might have been an alcoholic, but he got that together. At least I'm trying to make something positive out of it. Is it my fault? Be a reconciler. Okay, so how do we do that? Ultimately, friend, I'm going to share something with you that is foreign to many people. It is sharing the gospel. Okay, all right. If you're going to take down the church, keep the church from sharing the gospel. And then you got a serious problem on your hands. That's already happened, as I mentioned last week. Okay. When I step up here on this platform, You don't realize it, but this is what's going on in my head anyway. When I get up to about that top step there, or that one, I have to become immediately apolitical, right? I'm apolitical. I don't look at the world through a sociological lens, I try not to, a psychological lens, a cultural lens, a generational lens. I look at the world, I'm the guy maybe in your life that looks at the world through a theological lens. Okay, we don't always do that. I have to do that. I don't have a choice. So what I share with you, I share through a theological vehicle, right? On the bottom step, I might be really, really concerned what's going to happen in the next 4 years. But up here, I'm more concerned what's going to happen for eternity. Does that make sense? All right. So when I share things with you from a theological perspective, and hopefully I do a good job of it, and it's accurate and true and righteous, when I do those things, if you receive them through a sociological or a political filter, you're going to be going, say, what? If I say them in a way that challenges you or appears coarse or appears abrupt or appears like to come out of nowhere you didn't expect, I would liken it to this. Imagine you had a junior football team and you were the coach and you had practice every day. And you said, all right, boys, come on, we're going to get together, and girls, we're going to have practice today. Everybody line up, we're going to run some plays. Nobody, under any circumstances, ever during practice, tackle another person. Ever. And then they get to their first game, and they play XYZ rival, and they get their heads taken off. They get slammed to the ground. My approach from a theological standpoint, just so you know, is such that I am going to challenge you, I am going to be candid with you wherever I sense being led to do so, so that when you, not if, but when you are faced with greater levels of persecution and disagreement and insults and mockery, which are coming, you will have already been tackled a few times. Does that make sense? The last thing we need is a lot of powder puff Christians out there wanting to play touch football that are getting their heads taken off by linebackers that are 400 pounds. All right. I feel like that's my role. So I'm sharing this with you. The feet fitted for the readiness of the gospel. I think that we are, as a church, let's talk about our church. I think our church, some are doing a really good job of this. And others are not. I don't need to tell you who you are. You know that. The sharing of the gospel, the readiness of sharing the gospel. This is becoming a lost art. It's getting mixed, and we're getting distracted from it. It's getting overshadowed and shouted out because we've put our efforts into these very noble endeavors, political and otherwise. They mean a lot to us. But our activity, our energy, our focus throughout the nation has kept us from sharing the gospel, which is the ministry of reconciliation. If you don't have the ministry of reconciliation, at the end of the day, my friend, you don't have indivisible. You don't. So is that my fault? Yeah, it's my fault. It's your fault too. That's part of what the scheme is. Get enough people working on something that's noble and true and righteous to them and it means a lot and they're actively involved, all good. But at the end of the day, keep them from doing what they really are most dangerous at. What does Satan want more than anyone else? Worshippers. And what happens when he doesn't have them? His agenda, his scheme, his stronghold collapses. He loses the war. Now ask yourself the question, is that my fault? I don't know the answer. The world is already confused enough. And we have the one thing that brings clarity to the situation, but yet we withhold it. And this is problematic. Bring the shield of faith. Extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one. I was thinking, standing, when Adam Clayton stood in front of Bono and played his bass guitar, Bono had no idea he was there. He opened his eyes and there's the back of Adam's head, right? Adam stood, but said nothing. Sometimes we're asking ourselves what to do or what to say or how to say it. Sometimes I'm not sure we totally need to say anything. We need to engage in a defense of the gospel that's not always verbal. Sometimes it's just action. Sometimes it's just benevolence. Sometimes it's just compassion. But there's billions of people in the church today. If everyone was actually standing, oh, this wouldn't even be a contest. Wouldn't even be close to being a contest. As I said in the Gateway course this past week, why did Jesus remain silent before the shears? Isaiah said the lamb before the shears is silent. Why? Why wasn't he defending himself? Why wasn't he arguing his case? Why wasn't he telling them they were wrong? Why wasn't he engaging in some verbal battle? Why wasn't he debating with these people? Why wasn't he defending himself within an inch of his life? Well, two reasons. One, he came to die, and two, he's standing in your place and mine. He's standing in for us. What would we have to say in our defense that we're sinners? What would we have to say? We'd just stand there, wouldn't we? I would. Sometimes just standing doesn't mean talking. Sometimes it's just action. Sometimes it's always prayer. I don't know that we're called to always press forward. I think the battle tactics of a spiritual war are different than a regular war. And in a regular war, you charge the hill. You take the ground. You do it with vengeance and violence. How did Jesus handle the Roman Empire? How did he come against great divisibility? What did he do to rectify the situation? Did he do it in mass ways? No, he didn't. He did it with individuals. This verse right here, to me, in my life, I have to think about every day as I interact with the world. I'm going to share it with you. I'm going to tell you why I think it's important. Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. What does this word in Greek mean? It means crafty, subtle. It means shrewd. If I was crafty, if I was subtle, if I was shrewd, if I was wise, I think before I talk. I got a phone call one day in church out of the blue, and you don't have time to think about it. Like, hey, you got a call, so I answer the phone. And it's someone asking me if I will do their wedding. And I don't know, it seemed odd to me. Someone write about it. So rather than answer the question, which I wouldn't answer that right away anyway, I asked some more questions. Well, I think it was being recorded. I don't know for sure. It was an opportunity to get me as a representative of this church at the time that I received the call to engage in the affirmation of a wedding between two men. And I picked up on it. I didn't have an animosity towards the person. I tried to, be as cordial as possible and explain things, and it all went well. But you gotta think, you gotta be wise, okay? You gotta be wise. So this is what's going on in our world today. We have younger generation of 20s and 30s that came up in a different culture and environment than most of the people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. Well, it was quite different. Now, some of them were homeschooled, I get that. Some of them went to public school, I get that. But what was taboo to the older generation was acceptable or experimental behavior for the younger generation. Okay? That's the reality. So what people experienced in their high schools, what they saw other people experimenting with or doing in their high schools was 180 degrees different than an older generation today in the church ever thought about seeing or even talking about in their high school. You with me? So everything that that younger generation perceives being said goes through a filter of their culture, their life, their experience. And an older generation can say something, can demean a group of people, can say the most seemingly innocent, intolerant thing, and it's magnified to the ears of the younger generation who then have serious doubts about the church. This happens all the time. All the time. People in their 20s and 30s have, you can't see it, 20s. They have an antenna. It goes up about 40 feet. There's a dish on the top of it. They can hear everything, and they don't acknowledge that they heard a thing. And they're all ascertaining the validity of the church based on what the older generation is saying. Whether it's hypocrisy, whether it's whatever. All right, now magnify that with another problem. I used a word the other day in a conversation with my son, and the word was totally innocent. It was used in an informative way, almost in a scientific way. And he goes, "Dad, you can't use that word." I go, "What do you mean I can't use that word?" He goes, "Well, you just can't use that anymore. It's like that you can't use it anymore. The date for using that passed," he said. That's over. If you use it now, people will think you're like being incredibly critical and even evil. I thought, oh my gosh, I'm not gonna use that word. Mascots of athletic teams were decided decades ago with no malintent whatsoever, but now they're taboo. I'm not arguing whether that's right or wrong. What I'm saying is the culture has shifted, and now we have to be careful, wise like a serpent and gentle like a dove, which is why I think Jesus was saying this. If you talk about these issues, you may be right, you may be wrong, but more important than that is who's listening to it and how do they perceive it, and does it alienate them from the Lord? Do you lose credibility? Does it become a greater divisive issue or an issue of reconciliation? I'm not saying I like it, but I'm saying it's reality. It's reality. You've got to think through things now in ways you probably never did before. Now, I don't know if you had to do this in the 60s or not. Do anyone here remember the 60s? I don't know what you all were doing. I was too young. Okay, we got two. So I don't know. I don't know if this is a cyclical thing or not, but it's a reality today, and it's reality in the church today. It's not what you're saying, it's how you're perceived. So do you say, I'm just going to say it because I'm right? It depends. What's your goal? Because you may be right, but you may not reach your goal. Everything is permissible, but not everything is beneficial. Some things are better left unsaid or said in a different way. Or open up a dialogue. Here you go. Open up a dialogue about what is meant by what. So actually people, now we're reconcilers, you see. Very important. Money today is perceived differently than money was 20 years ago. To a younger generation, I started learning this early on in my ministry. I was in a youth group one time. I said, yeah, we need to get some new lights to go in the youth room because these lights that we have are terrible. They go, please don't spend the money on the lights. That's what they told me. Please don't spend money on the lights. Let's take the money we would have spent on the lights and let's send it to an orphanage. And what happened is the church, the mega churches, started popping up all over the place, and great budgets were accumulated for these mass media type things. And a younger generation looked at that, who was more cause oriented, and said, man, that's a waste of money. I'm bringing all this up to tell you that you don't know it, and I don't know it all the time, but sometimes we're contributing to divisiveness or we're alienating people when we're standing for something that is right, but we're not standing in the right manner. You may not like that. I don't like it either. But I'm telling you, that's what's going on. I'm telling you because we talk to teenagers and we listen to them, and that's what they tell us. We can keep doing it. It's no problem. We keep doing it. But the problem is, in about 40 years, we're going to have a congregation of about 5 or 6. Yeah? You got to think about that. Okay. So the question is, how can you and I be reconcilers? Reconcilers. The better the church is at reconciliation, the better. Ultimately, reconciling people to Christ. I don't know what that looks like in your life. Maybe you do. We need to be asking that question. We have people in our church that, one writing a book right now, I'm reviewing a book to endorse a book for somebody. We have people that write articles in newspapers, myself included. We have people that write articles in Florida, myself included. We have people that write in op-ed sections of major newspapers. We have people who have speaking engagements. We have people who lead companies. We have people who lead in ministries. We have people who lead foundations. We have people in places of influence from this congregation all over the place. I ask you to ask the question, how might we bring about change from a standpoint of reconciliation, or at least, I don't know, transparency? I don't know what the answer is. But we got to start asking these questions because we got the world that's falling apart. How is it that we're in the world but not of it? And how do we become distinguishable from the rest of the world instead of lumped in and labeled with them and having to withstand the abuse that the world is getting, and we get linked in with it because we're the church? How do you differentiate between those two things? I don't have the answer to that either. But I do know we need to pray. And we have an allegiance towards Christ to make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. If you have a problem, let your problem be known to the person you have a problem with. That's a start right there. If we can't take care of that within among us, we can't take care of that in the world. We have got to be able to confront one another, to talk, to dialogue, to develop this open lines of communication, because we've got a whole world out there that, quite frankly, is going to hell. Now, this may totally blow your mind, but I am up here in an apolitical zone up here. There are Republicans who aren't saved. Do you realize that? There are Democrats that aren't saved. Do you realize that? There are libertarians who aren't saved. There are nations of people that aren't saved. Just a thought. On the night our Lord was betrayed, I don't know what was going on in his mind, but this is, think about it, it's the last opportunity you're going to have to talk to people. In about an hour, they're going to be in the Garden of Gethsemane, and they're not even going to keep these people awake long enough to talk with him, right? They're dozing off. This is it. I bet they had a big dessert for the last meal, don't you think? Insulin rush, can't pray. Don't quote me on that. When he takes this bread and he looks at it, he says, "This is my body. I'm broken for you." So, I don't know. I don't know what limitations, if any, he had on him in that moment. I don't know if he foreknew what would happen to each one of these disciples in their life. I don't know. I would say probably yes. So he's holding this up and he's looking around the room and he says, "This is my body broken for you." And he looks at James, foreknowing his body would be thrust from the temple mount onto the ground and he would be bludgeoned to death. And he says, "This is my body broken for you." He looks at Thomas, knowing that he's going to be impaled in a cave in India. And he says, "This is my body broken for you." Looks at Peter, he knows he's going to be hung upside down on a cross out of respect for Christ. "This is my body broken for you." Looks at John, he's going to be boiled in oil. "This is my body broken for you." What's the point here? Christ goes before you. His body was broken before theirs was. He experiences what he knows we will experience. He doesn't take executive privilege and keep himself from the very things that his followers will actually experience. This is my body broken for you. You see that? Now then, just take that principle and think about this world and who you're going to talk with, who you're going to interact with, who you're going to pray for, who you're going to pray with, who you're going to share the gospel with, and know that he goes before you. He's already seeded the conversation. He's already postured the hearts of the people having the conversation. When he sends the Israelites into Canaan, God's already sat in on the military strategy of the invasion of the Israelites on the Canaanite side. He already knows their battle plan. He already knows their defense. He already knows how to take Jericho before Jericho knows it's going to be taken. This is my body broken for you. God has gone ahead of you like a pillar of fire by night and a cloud by day. He's already gone ahead of you, and sometimes he gets ahead of us and prepares us for what he's calling us to do, and we never act upon it, so his preparation gets wasted. There are appointments set for you this week to engage people in conversation that God's already set up. It's like going to the dentist. And it's not like the dentist, because at the dentist, you can just not show up. We don't show up, we've not been a good steward. Are you a reconciler? Because if you ask the question if you're a reconciler, the opportunities for reconciliation will come and you'll understand that they exist and you'll know what to do in them. This is my body broken for you. Christ has gone ahead of you in advance of what you, my friend, are called to do. Let's partake of the body of Christ. The reality that every 3 or 4 years we bring up the subject of spiritual warfare as a series. It's a necessary staple in a spiritual diet of a group of people. You can't neglect spiritual warfare. I didn't say it was enjoyable. I didn't say it was fun. You just can't neglect it. To be honest with you, I'm glad it's over. But nonetheless, it reminds me of this reality. These men he's sending out from that table, he's sending them out into the wolves. And it's so important that you leave here today, or if you're listening today, you listen to what I'm saying, as you have your elements as well. I'm praying for a bloodline over your mind, a bloodline over your marriage, a bloodline over your home, your finances, a bloodline over your health, a blood over the doorpost of your home, where death and hopelessness and despair and lack and depression pass over. Yeah, the bloodline, the blood that justifies and sanctifies, atones for and covers the sin of man. May that bloodline be over you today and over your heart. And may it be just rushing and washing over everything in your life as you partake of the cup, that you are set apart and consecrated and protected by the blood of Jesus Christ.